From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Well, we've got to the end of the series celebrating the best seasons in Formula One history. We've had 9 episodes where a special guest has picked out their favourite season. But this time, we're going to look at some of the other options, some of the honourable mentions, or perhaps their years that should have been in the list in the first place. And joining me to talk about those are two people who did have their say, but are capable of talking about many other seasons. First of all, it's former GP Racing editor and current F1 reporter, Stuart Codling. Stuart, welcome to the Autosport Podcast. How are you doing?
Brilliant, and I'm glad that I get to talk about the other season that I mentioned in our discussion of 1976, I believe it was. More of a dishonourable mention for 1982, but it's a season we've got to talk about because there's lots of great racing, as well as, I believe, Nigel Roebuck described it as an ugly season.
Yes, that's probably fair. And also joining us is normally our sports car guru, but actually, as we've said before, lots of knowledge, interest, enthusiasm and experience in many other fields, including Formula One, Gary Watkins. How are you, Gary?
Not too bad. Thank you for inviting me. And yeah, I came on to talk about 1983, which is my absolute all-time favourite season of Formula One. And there's a few on your list of the sort of the bubbling unders, if you like, that I quite like, and a few that I'm thinking, really? But yeah, let's get on to discuss them.
Yeah, well, before we do that, let's just go through the years in the previous episodes that we're not talking about, because we've already done that, and they are 1976, 1977, 1983. 1986, which was the correct answer, well done, Damien Smith. 1993, 1997, 1999, 2007, and 2012. So we won't be talking about those other than to reference them as we go along. So let's get started.
Great-looking cars in 1983, weren't they?
Oh, and this was part of my...
Yeah. No. We've done 1983.
I wanted to talk about it again.
the only time a last-minute rule change has ever actually improved things.
Oh, that's like a different podcast. Yes. That's an interesting one. Before we start to go through some of the lists that I put together, I'm going to throw it to you, chap. Stuart, have you got... what was your second best choice, and what's the other year that you would have put forward?
It was 1982, and I believe that is on our list to talk about today.
It is. We can do that. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to outline why 1982 could have been in the list, and then we can talk about why it probably didn't make it in.
Great, close racing, hotly contested. You had so much going on in 1982. You know, you kick off, you've got Long Beach, Andrea De Cesaris on pole in, what was it, an Alfa Romeo, loses the lead of the race. For what reason? Because he takes his hand off the wheel to wave his fist off the gear stick, waves his fist to the back marker instead of changing gear.
See, if only they'd invented the paddle shift a few years earlier.
Niki Lauda must have been laughing as he took the lead. At that point,
mostly. And then, you know, Monaco, darling. Who is going to win that race? You wouldn't have thought it was going to be Ricardo Patrese when he spun, but then no one else seemed to want to win. So really, really dramatic season. You have Mario Andretti making a comeback, obviously in the absence of Didier Pironi, putting the Ferrari on pole for the Italian Grand Prix. Just a love story for the Tifosi. And of course, a world champion who only wins one race. And a lot of people say, oh, Keke Rosberg only won one race. He must be the most underwhelming world champion ever. Not so, you know, did absolute miracles with the DFV-powered car against a field of turbos.
I would say go and watch the season review or individual races and just watch the body language of that Williams and Rosberg's racing. He is just on it all the time. Great improviser, up against it. Obviously, miles off in qualifying because he didn't have boost to turn up. But in the race, he's always fantastically entertaining to watch. So although he only won one race, I'd never begrudged in that title. I mean, no one won more than two. I guess one of the reasons this should be up there is there are 11 different winners from 7 different teams, which is a record. Well, I don't think that's going to go. You can never say never, but that seems pretty unlikely.
And can I also interject here, as I've already observed on X, formerly known as Twitter, having watched the F1 film and enjoyed it despite its many sillinesses. But one thing that struck me was the Brad Pitt's character, Sonny Hayes, obviously ridiculously old for a Grand Prix driver, but I came out of that film thinking, you know, he's precisely the sort of character that Frank Williams and Patrick Head would have loved to employ in the golden age of Williams.
That's probably fair.
Very much cut from the same cloth as Keckie Rosberg and Alan Jones.
Well, I was going to say, of course, actually, one of the storylines for the 82 season is that Alan Jones probably should have been in the Williams and would probably have won the World Championship, because you think he would have done at least as good a job, bearing in mind where he was in his career. So he sort of gave Rosberg an opportunity, which he took. So, I mean, Gary, you picked 83, so 82 would have been a candidate for you.
For me, 82 is a great season. Because of, as Cotter says, of all the different cars that won, and it was an open season. But, you know, the caveat to that, of course, is that, you know, it's a very sad season with the loss of Gilles Villeneuve and obviously Didier Pironi having his big accident.
And Carlo Paletti, of course, with his crash as well.
Paletti, you know, had we not had that tragedy with Ferrari, would we be talking about this as we might still be talking about it as a great season, for Gilles Villeneuve winning the title or Didier Pironi winning the title, you know. And I think that there's a very good chance that, you know, had those accidents not happened, one of those drivers would have won the championship.
Yeah, I think there's an argument to say that a lot of these seasons, especially the further back we go, will there be tragedy somewhere.
Well, that's a good point, isn't
82 is such a, you know, two deaths, Pironi's career basically finished. A bit too much, I think you'd say, by 80 standards.
But, well, for me, if we were talking about, you know, in this parallel universe, and it was a Ferrari world champion, I think I'd be talking about it as a great season, because the Ferrari 126 C2 was a thing of beauty. You know, the first Harvey Postlethwaite Ferrari, just a beautiful racing car.
Yeah.
One of the all time. It's up there in my top 10. Best looking racing cars.
Oh, interesting. Which is a list that we're
Well, just stay tuned, listeners.
Keke Rosberg won with 44 points and one win. Didier Pironi, despite missing half the season, actually finished second with John Watson. They both finished on 39 points and two wins each. I would argue that in terms of pace, the Renault RE30 was the car that should have won. In fact, I did a piece a while ago, being the fastest failure in F1 history. Yep. And the Renault had a qualifying performance advantage of 0.7%, which covers basically the entire field pretty much these days. And they led half the races, Alain Prost and René Arnoux, but only won a couple each. Prost ended up fourth with 34 points, which was, I mean, Renault never got, I mean, we talked about it in the 83 podcast, they just never got it done despite bringing the technology in.
Yes, that's true.
It was a case of when rather than if the car was going to blow up, especially in 82. Was it Austrian Grand Prix? There was so many cars blowing up. Well, it was carnage, wasn't it?
I was actually there.
Really?
One of the closest F1 race, F1 finishes in history.
That's right. Yeah. And it was a great, I mean, how old was I? I was 15, and just turned 15. And it was a great thing to do on a Page and Moore trip with my parents. A double header, actually, with Hockenheim, because they were back to back that year. And a great thing to do. And I'm forever grateful to my parents for taking me there. So if you're listening, Mum, cheers. but yeah, that, A, the Osterreich ring, the old Osterreich ring, the Osterreich ring, not the present Red Bull ring, you know, was just an amazing track.
Scary fast.
Yes. And it was a great race, a great finish. And of course, what we didn't know is that it was to be the last Chapman era Lotus win.
Mm.
You know, so the last time the Caldroy cap went up in the air, but, and he did do it.
Conspiracy podcast series. But only just, because obviously Elio De Angelis was, I mean, Keke Rosberg was alongside him across the line, wasn't he? Having sort of woken up in the last few laps.
And the other thing is, I got stung by a bee only once twice in my life.
Really? Well, there we go.
It was very hot.
Not sure if that counts as a pro or gone when it comes. So Gary, okay, so if 1983 or 1982 hadn't been your choice, what other years would you like to throw into the mix?
Do you want me to choose one of those?
You choose whatever you like.
Oh, right. Okay.
We can cover off any sensible seasons, I think.
1976 and 77 have been chosen. But, you know, for me, 79 you know, that great season with Ligier, quick with the jest.
And that was a good looking car.
Yeah. Oh, straight out of the box. Then other people coming, you know, winning races. Then the FWA7 arriving and becoming the dominant force. Wasn't that a great year? Just the way it sort of seesawed a bit.
That's amazing, actually. I don't know why, but 1979 didn't come to me as a candidate.
Really?
But actually, that's, yeah.
Was that the year of the... Was the British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch that year?
No, still since Clay Regazzoni's Williams first win.
Oh, yeah, so it was. No, I'm thinking of a different year with James Hunt and Jackie Stewart having a Barney in the commentary booth.
That was that must have been 80.
Yeah.
Because they were arguing about...
whether you could see out the mirror.
Yeah. Jackie Stewart and James Hunt argued about whether Pironi could see
that
he had a
rear
puncture. And now I can't remember. And basically James Hunt said, well, I know because I was driving these cars not so long ago, actually. And then Jackie went, oh, yeah, but I tested such and such
for
recently.
Wide World of Sport. And
yeah, you know, yeah. But anyway. So, yeah, and of course, you know, 79, Ferrari, you know, returned to winning the championship, you know, and with the T312 T4, another great car.
Yeah, beautiful
so wasn't that,
car, yeah.
You know, and it was sort of Ferrari, you know, won the championship with old tech, didn't they? You know, the flat 12, a boxer engine, compromised the ground effect. So it's just
it was the last time they could, because obviously everyone else got on top of it. They were absolutely
time was moving
stuffed.
On, you know.
I mean, I know that some would say, oh, yeah, but that was just your win of letting JJ Scheckter win a world championship. It was actually
not
correct. I remember looking at the races and qualifying stats of that, and up until the point that he clinches the championship at Monza, Scheckter is actually ahead in the qualifying and race runs marginally, and then obviously quite clearly after that he loses all interest for the next year and a bit, and then Villeneuve is obviously much faster.
Another of the great underrated world champions, I'd say, JJ Scheckter.
Yeah, I think, you know, top driver, you know, and let's not forget that he won Grand Prix with three different teams.
Yeah, Wolf.
Yeah, Tyrrell, Wolf and Ferrari.
You know, and that's, I think that's significant. And I was talking about this in another podcast, wasn't I? About, you know, drivers able to win with different teams and different...
Ah, this is a brilliant segue. It's not planned at all, because one of the ones I'm going to go older than you guys. So the season that I want to talk about first, 1958, one of the championship protagonists won for two different teams with two different cars in the same season.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Because, of course, Stirling Moss won the Argentinian Grand Prix and Rob Walker Cooper, which caught everyone by surprise, didn't do a tyre stop. It's a well-known story. Mm-hmm. Pretended they were going to do one. By the time that the Italians worked out it wasn't happening, it was too late and he won the race. And then, of course, Van Wall, who hadn't been ready for the first. Imagine that leading team not being ready for the... No, we're not going to do that one. He then won three Grand Prix for Van Wall, but lost the championship by a point to Mike Hawthorn. So it was a good championship fight. I thought the cars were... I like those front engines, Grand Prix cars. I think they look great. You've got the rise of the mid-engine Cooper, but hasn't quite overtaken yet. Tony Brooks, Peter Collins. This is your post-one Manuel Fangio, who's going to fill the void.
Yeah. I mean, it was a real change of the order, wasn't it? That you had previous seasons dominated by Fangio, and then he's, you know, the switch has gone off in his brain somewhere around Christmas 1957, and he comes back, he's fourth in the season opener?
Fourth in the French Grand Prix was his last race when he was almost lapped, but allegedly Hawthorn saw him and went, well, I'm not going to lap the great man.
Just on your point of talking about Stirling winning in Argentina with Rob Walker and the pit stop, I'm not sure they would have been able to do a pit stop. It had been very slow because there was only one mechanic there. I know this because however many years ago when the Argentinian Grand Prix made a comeback, let's try and come up with some kind of Argentinian Grand Prix pre-retro feature. So I rang Rob Walker and asked him to talk about Argentina, and he goes, my dear boy, I wasn't there. I didn't go. Couldn't afford it.
Which was clearly a lie. But, well, also, they had, it was multi-studs on the wheels. They didn't have the, like, the knockoff.
Oh, really?
The, yeah. So it would have taken them, it'd still be too.
Very long time.
To be honest, then it was a bit stupid of everyone else to realise that they were... not to realise that they were going to try and go through.
A modern team boss now going, nah, we're not falling for this bluff. But I think ultimately for me, 58, I mean, we're talking about death. Stuart Lewis Evans obviously killed in the final round when Van Wall comes the first Constructors champion, of course, 1958. Yeah, so there'll be another anniversary to celebrate for Formula One in a few years' time. But for me...
And F1 will get it right, will they, actually, on the...
Oh, well...
Oh, yes. Dear, oh, dear.
Formula One did not begin in 1950s.
A can of worms, yes. I think.
But I've said in previous episodes, I do think that the best season F1 history has to be won by the correct driver.
Right.
For me, I know other people might. And for me, Mike Hawthorn was not the correct world champion for 1950. I'm sorry, all Hawthorn, if there are any left. Well, I mean, there were a lot in the correspondence pages of Autosport for years after that saying, oh, he did deserve it. I'm sorry, if you win one race and your main rival wins four, that's out of 10. That's incorrect.
Would it please you to learn that the Tourist Trophy garage in Farnham, which up until recently was a branch of Carpetright, is now being done over and being made into a branch of Greggs.
Right, there you go.
Yeah.
Am I right saying, of all Moss's second places in the championships, was 58 was the year he won the most Grand Prix?
Yes, this is the most egregious, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll scrub it from the list.
Fine.
I think it's worth noting as a great championship. Certainly the fact that they all of a sudden decided at the beginning of the year to ban, was it Avgas they were going to
start
they
had to pull pump
on.
Fuel, yeah.
So that was why Van Wall couldn't go. So it was very much a last minute thing for Moss to go. And that acted as the canary in the coal mine for the rear-ended revolution. But everyone thought those were outlier wins. Just 10 cars on the grid in
Argentina. But in a way, the more significant win is Maurice Trintignant winning at Monaco, because Moss winning anything was like, well, you know, it's Stirling, isn't it? But then when Trintignant, who was, I think, probably fair to say, a decent journeyman and not a lot
and not in his first flush of youth.
Won the Monaco Grand Prix again. that people thought, So, but yeah, of course, the revolution didn't really happen until 1959, did it, with the Works Cooper team? But,
I think Monaco 1958 was what Nigel Mansell would have described as a race of nutrition.
I don't know how to respond to that, I'll be honest. Any other seasons that you guys want to throw into the mix before I just sort of cover off a few?
Well, I'm going to say that two of yours I like, 73, but I'd also, you know, 74 is another one for me, which is, again, you know, going to the wire, three different people in the mix.
Yeah.
So 74.
And Fittipaldi having to get his elbows out at the end with Regazzoni. Emerson, who was a driver well known for...
Sort of the artist.
Yeah, the artist.
Against smooth, the bruiser.
The artist against a bruiser, and... That was the case, wasn't it, in the US Grand Prix towards the end. He had to assert himself, seize the moment, as a former colleague of ours would say, and basically get a wheel on the grass.
And I think Regazzoni thought about jinking towards him, and then I was like, I'm not moving.
Yeah.
And he said at that moment, I think even Clay realised it was, this was it sort of thing. So
he was, I remember talking about Jackie Stewart, and sort of, I remember reading something by Jackie Stewart, you know, not so long after he retired. So we're probably just talking late 70s here. And he was talking about Regazzoni. He did little pen portraits on the drivers, I don't know, before the season in a magazine. And he talked about Regazzoni's sort of on track antics, and in particular, the fact that he liked to have a bit of a weave down the straight.
Yes. Dubious track ethics. Yeah. When did he go from being sort of, that sort of dubious track guy to the kind of older statesman of F1?
Well, he did, didn't he?
He seemed to have at the end.
I wouldn't say he became a paddock treasure. I can't call him a national treasure, but a paddock treasure.
Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?
And I think perhaps from a British point of view, it's driving for Enzyme, Shadow, Enzyme in particular, because I think people liked... Enzyme as a sort of plucky underdog. Obviously, and the sort of circumstances of his, you know, the end of his career. And of course, we should go back to, you know, scoring Williams's first Grand Prix. So, you know, going from Ensign Shadow, this resurgence, because he gets picked up by Williams, wins them their first Grand Prix. Then, you know, then the sad circumstances of his death. But I must admit, I was lucky enough to meet Clay Regazzoni several times years later. And he did actually do a little bit of racing in my world. He did some BPR, a couple of BPR races. And he was, I just thought, what a great guy. You know, really nice guy. Yeah. Seemed like a complete gentleman, unlike how it looked sometimes.
Yeah, it was very interesting. In the Rush film, he's portrayed very sort of sympathetically. There's no mention of his dubious on-track antics there. He's very, you know, he's portrayed as the great teammate to Lauda.
That's not what he's remembered as now, is it? Perhaps because of that sort of second half of his career, whatever. But
and he's also not remembered as a top liner, you know.
No.
And okay, we're not going to say he was a great, but you know, how many races did it take him to win a Grand Prix? Four or five?
Yeah, yeah. For Ferrari, 1970,
And often a front runner in those eras, so...
That's true.
History's been slightly unkind in terms of...
I mean, 70... Well,
in some ways it's been unkind, in some ways it's been kind.
Yes, yeah.
It's been kind to him as a person, perhaps, but unkind to him as a racing driver.
Yeah, perhaps that's fair. For me, 1974, again, who should have been champion, like the best driver of 1974 was Niki Lauda, and he wasn't even in the title fight.
Well, okay,
I mean, you put that right, obviously, the following. Yeah. Well, maybe this is a good time to talk about the criteria.
Well,
what is a great season?
Well, it's not just one thing, is it?
No, of course not. But how do you weight them, man, perhaps? Because you want multiple winners, you want a championship fight, you want a couple of really classic races.
Good-looking racing cars.
Ideally, good-looking racing cars.
Which is that we've got a couple of those coming up.
Yeah, ideally, no fatalities, although as we go further back, that does become rather more tricky. And then, for me, the right world champion, but I feel like other people are less bothered. It's more about the contest than the outcome. Is that fair?
I think the contest is important, isn't it? And, you know, I chose 1983, and the contest was an important part of that, wasn't it? Because, you know, it was a freeway fight at the end, and it was a, you know, there was a great battle between Renault and Brabham. You know, you think of the Dutch Grand Prix, don't we? And Prost and Piquet coming together. But for me, there were personal reasons. And if you don't know what they are, you'll have to go back and listen to the podcast. But also because of the beauty of the cars.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think that is. So do we want to segue quickly forward there? Or we haven't really talked about 73?
Well, let's just finish off 73. The reason I put that in, and perhaps this is it's a different list, but I think that Jackie Stewart's campaign in 73 is one of the great F1 campaigns up there with, say, Prost in 86, for example, winning a car that wasn't the best. Does that make it a great season? Maybe one question, but also just the variety of the cars. The Tyrrell 006 looks utterly different to the Lotus 72. Like you paint them white and you really will still know what they are.
Yeah. Very much so. And also you had the Ferrari, the 312B3 name, which covered basically three very different cars, didn't it? You know, you had the Spazza Neve that Mara Forghieri developed with that season in mind, booted into the long grass because everyone thought it was ugly. He got sent off to Korea, Siberia in the off season, and they bring out this car, new technical director who's never designed a Formula One car before. What could possibly go wrong? It's subcontracted to England to be built around a monocoque chassis. How on earth do they get the Imperial versus Metric working?
Well, John Thompson, who built that, had to go out and... I did a story about this a few years ago, and he told me, I had to go out and buy some metric rulers, you know, meter rules. You know, maybe if you're making monocoque chassis, you can buy a 2 meter rule or a 3 meter rule as well. But he didn't have any metric measuring devices.
Incredible, isn't
it?
Which is crazy.
And
think
of Ferrari subcontracting, you know, Enzo Ferrari, who dismissed the British makers as mere garagistes, has to send his man out to subcontract the car to be built. And even then, it's rubbish.
But it was. I mean, again, we had five winners, three teams. I would argue actually that the Tyrrell was the third best car of the season, because as well as the Lotus 72, which took the Constructors' Championship with seven wins split across Emerson Fittipaldi and Ronnie Peterson, I think the McLaren 23 was also better than the Tyrrell. But with all due respect to Peter Revson,
was on the way to being better.
I still think if you give it to Jackie Stewart in 73, he's gone. To be
the
honest.
Other thing I'm going to say is that I have Corgi models of all three cars.
I had Corgi models. Yeah.
I think I did a swapsies for the Lotus 72 and it was a bit scratched, but my 006 was definitely new. Can't remember about my McLaren M23 in Yardley colours.
We had two. My dad had a perfect Tyrrell. Then I had a really knackered chipped one with all the stickers off, which obviously is the one that got raced. But I tended to make the Lotus 72 win just because I thought it looked cooler when I was a kid.
Talking about that season and the 006, you say very different. Short wheelbase car.
Yes.
It made for some brilliant photographs.
Yeah. And it was always quite perpendicular, was it?
And I'd love to have actually seen or seen more footage from that year. Of course, you know, F1 not on live TV at that time. But, you know, to me, Stewart made that car dance, didn't he? I mean, you had to drive it like that.
And to think that Stewart was, you know, the man who wanted to be super smooth. You know, he was known for running at the slowest possible speed. He liked to be smooth. And yet he had this car with a short wheelbase that was edgy and needed to be driven.
Well, I think Derek Gardner, who designed all those early series of the 001.
Well, all the way up to the D34.
Yeah, said that he could do that because he knew that Stewart was of a calibre hold. A twitchy car, this has come up a few times recently, a twitchy agile car is faster.
Yeah,
how much can you hang on to it? This is why Verstappen can hang on to cars that other people can't. Lewis Hamilton used to be able to do that. Marcus Schumacher always wanted a pointy car. The great drivers usually want a pointy
car. Racing.
Yes.
It's like 2008, and for me, the greatest Le Mans of all time, victory by McNish.
That was my first Le Mans in person, yeah.
And Capello in the aging and compromised Audi R10 turbo diesel. Now, they set that car up quite oversteery, twitchy. The other cars were, you know, for example, Pirro and Bieler both liked an understeery car, just not quick enough. But Christensen and McNish and Capello could hang on to it, and that was crucial. And I actually wrote before the race in our Le Mans supplement that there was only going to be one Audi that could take the fight to Peugeot, and Pirro got a bit upset with me about that, but I was right.
And then showed you wrong. I mean, even in the first stint, it was three Peugeots and an Audi, and
From the get-go.
It was, I remember.
But you know.
Yeah, come on, Gary, I thought you wanted to talk about F1.
It is
good, yeah. So what year did you want to bring us to then?
We were talking about great-looking cars, so let's go to 1990.
I think 1990 was on my list.
Yes.
So it ticks a lot. You've got lots of great drivers, good-looking cars, multi-winners. You've got actually six winners across four teams, because obviously Nelson Piquet popped up at the end to score two to Benetton. So
although I'm a Piquet fan, he was an inheritor, right?
Oh, yeah.
He was. Well, actually, the Australian Grand Prix win, I think, was a really good drive.
Yeah, okay.
He stepped up and held off of charging Nigel Mansell there. So fair play to him.
Mind you, Nigel sort of self-sabotaged towards the end, didn't he, by overcooking it.
I think that showed how much, even after it had happened, he could have easily just piled into the back of the Benetton. And you can see him, he's avoiding the crash. He's gone in deep. Yeah. He's made one last bid on, I think it's the last lap, wasn't it, or penultimate lap? Gone down the inside and didn't work, locked up, but he misses the Benetton. And I thought that was fair enough. Also, one of the great races of all time, we do a separate podcast, that 1990 Mexican Grand Prix, I think, is right up there.
Very much.
1990 would probably have been my choice, because I think the cars were great looking and all the things were said, except for turn one at the Japanese Grand Prix, which, and I don't want to get involved with Senna fans, because I'm sure that it's all Prost's fault and being on the wrong side of the track and all that stuff, but it is the single most terrible piece of driving, I think, in F1 history.
Utterly egregious.
Deliberately drive flat out into a rival in front of a pack of cars at 150 miles an hour and ruining the championship fight as well as being incredibly dangerous would be my line through 1990, unfortunately.
It's funny, actually, that I just read a comment posted at the bottom of the page of my 1983 our 1983 podcast, and it said, oh, you know, dodgy fuel, couldn't you have picked a year that wasn't so tainted or something like that? You know, and you could use the same argument here, couldn't you? You know, because it, I mean, for me, it is worse than Suzuka the previous year, Prost turning in on him.
Yes.
It's, yeah. It's A, because it's more premeditated, and B, because of the speeds that it takes place at. And let's not forget that those two incidents set the tone, changed racing, I think, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
They changed
motor racing. A generation of drivers grew up watching Senna and started to...
And Prost. You know, Prost...
Yeah,
and
it became an acceptable thing to drive into another driver.
You know, Schumacher's antics, wherever he wants, say, you know, in Australia or down the straits, you know.
Jerez as well, in 1997.
It all goes back to those incidents.
And now this is why I also have scratched 2021, because that was one of the most intense championship fights. But for me, my problem with Max Verstappen is he sort of reinvented that Senna-Schumacher line. I think we had an era of not that with Fernando Alonso, Lewis Hamilton, Kimi Raikkonen, Jensen Button, Sebastian Vettel. Hard but fair races, I would argue, by and large. They had clashes.
Well, we have a picture of that moment of stupidity at Monza on our office wall.
2021, yes. Yeah, 2021 is ruined for me by the fact that you want wheel-to-wheel fights, I think, between your championship protagonists, although that was something we put to Caroon when he picked 1997. Jack Villeneuve and Michael Schumacher hardly saw each other during that season until the end.
Same with 1976 and Lauda and Hunt as well.
I suppose they had maybe a couple more, but certainly it was sort of pendulum backwards and forwards a little bit, and obviously Nicky missing races. But 2021, it felt like every time there was a chance for a good race, there was a crash. Usually it was Verstappen's fault, we don't need to get into that, but that's why I've scratched that one as well, because I think there needs to be a certain purity of competition in this, if that doesn't sound too pompous. So
it does sound pompous, but it's also right.
I'll take that as a combination. Any other years that we would like to mention? I've got a couple of others just to tick off.
We have 1964 on our list, which is another one that, you know, you could say, did the right person win? Should it have been Jim Clark? Well, obviously every championship in the 1960s and from Clark's debut to his untimely death should have been Jim Clark.
How many points did he win in the second half of the year? Two?
Yeah.
Still finished second in the championship?
Yeah. And was in contention right to the end. And what happens in the last race of the season? But, oh no, the car breaks again.
Yes. I mean, he was undone by Lotus unreliability. But I do remember speaking to John Surtees about this season. He'd say, yes, that everyone remembers that. But I had all sorts of car problems with the Ferrari at the start of the year. And remember when John Surtees joined Ferrari for 63, they were in the mire after half the team had left, you know, gone to set up ATS. Mm. They didn't win a race in 62. And I think he deserves some credit. I think John Surtees was better than a lot of people.
Oh, really? I've never thought that he was a sort of lucky world champion or anything like that. I'm not going to say I'm going to put him in my top dozen F1 drivers of all time.
Top 20, top 25 rather than top 10, possibly. Yeah,
I'd probably agree with you.
Although if he'd made better decisions, I mean, I think if he stays at Ferrari in 1966, he wins another world championship, probably.
Yes.
But actually, I think this is one of those seasons where they'll go to the finale with John Surtees, Graham Hill, BRM and Jim Clark all in with a chance. And actually, at various points during the race, any one of them is in lines.
Right.
When Clark retires, Surtees at that point is still third. Uh-huh. Dan Gurney is in the lead in the Brabham. Another great season. He should have been in the championship fight, and he completely outpaced teammate Jack Brabham to show how good Gurney was.
Well, yeah, and you think, you know, that Brabham is still in his pomp then, you know.
Yeah, very much.
Well,
so.
Yeah, good. How good was he in 1970 when he was aged 45?
Allegedly over the hill.
He writes in his autobiography that, this is Jack Brabham, he was, by the end of 65, he was happy to step back and let Gurney be the lead driver for 66, uh-huh. which if you think about it, would have been the world champion, yeah, wouldn't he? So,
right.
So but 64, I think. Any
had the eagle, would we? You know?
No, exactly. So I'm
now
not.
That, now we're no, good
we
looking
are in a good looking car. Again, Ron Dennis' so, favourite Formula One car.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Seriously.
So,
and I think the other thing you've got to say about that final race of 1964 is imagine what the AWS graphics would have been like if a race like that eventuated nowadays with the potential outcome of the world championship changing.
Yeah, because Clark was going to win it, then he broke down. Graham Hill had been knocked out after a clash with Lorenzo Bandini, Cersei's his teammate.
Yes.
But actually, even though he was sat on the sidelines with Clark out at that point, Hill was going to be world champion. Bandini slows down the last lap, lets Cersei's into second, wins the championship by a point, but only on drop scores.
Yeah.
This is one of two occasions in F1 history where the drop score rule actually changes the world champion, the other one being...
84?
No. But you're in the right ballpark. It's McLaren drivers.
Was it 85?
No, so in 1988, Alain Prost scored more points than Ayrton Senna, but lost the best 11.
Back in the day when people could actually do maths without a calculator.
Yeah, but some of the rules in the 70s, best six results from the first eight and your best six from the last seven.
And if three hens had laid addled eggs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do think all points counting makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I do as well.
The only other years I had on my list to mention, one was 2000, the Schumacher-Hakkinen year, but I had that really on in terms of the purity and level of competition they got to by the end of the year, that Japanese Grand Prix qualifying session and then the race.
Yeah.
Two great drivers, the absolute peak, exchanging thousands.
Do you think they were at their peak? I think Hakkinen was at his peak then. Do you not think... I think Schumacher was...
Was he still on the way to his peak?
He
all controversial opinions are about to come out here.
What we can say about Schumacher is he probably had a very flat peak.
Yes.
There was some hand movements there, which would have really enhanced.
He was up there for a long time.
It was a plateau.
Well, to say
it was a high plateau.
To say plateau sort of seems to be talking down. Yeah.
When was peak Marcus Schumacher? I mean, I always thought 96, 97 when he had cars that weren't quite good enough. But actually, we've seen it's actually quite hard to reel off win after win after win, title after title, even if you've got the best car. And the great drivers do it.
That is why Schumacher is one of the greatest, you know, he's up there in the top 2, 3, 4 greatest drivers of all time, because he got to Formula One and he kept on getting better.
Yeah.
Now when that stopped, you know, that'd be a great story to write, to talk to race engineers and stuff like that. But, you know, I really think...
Well, also
2000, McLaren was the better car on paper, but... they self-sabotaged. The engine kept blowing up. McLaren themselves having weird finger trouble. Was that the year? It was the first US Grand Prix at Indianapolis, wasn't it? And they pitted Hakkinen for dry tyres, and he came up behind Gaston Mazzacane, who hadn't changed. And so he couldn't get past because, you know, there was still a dry line. And he got that fundamental strategy error.
Yeah.
And at that point... Hakkinen had gone from being a position of being behind in the world championship, which actually he'd overtaken Michael, and then the balance shifted again in those final couple of races.
I think at the end of the season, Nigel Roebuck, I believe it was, wrote basically that Hakkinen's ability and strength across 2000 gave extra credibility to Schumacher's title.
Yeah,
right, because there was someone of a similar level operating at the same time.
And that was, I'm going back to my point, that was peak Hakkinen. I think Hakkinen's peak was a genuine peak.
Yeah.
Passed on to Spa that year was...
Was he better that year than when he won his titles?
I think he was, because I remember...
Certainly 99, he made more mistakes in 99, didn't he?
For much of 2000, was working on... McLaren had an in-house magazine called Racing Line. Do you remember that? Racing Line.
Yes.
I worked on that.
You can't have nostalgia about 2000. It's not long enough ago, surely.
And I remember at the
quarter of a century, mate.
Yeah, 25 years. The beginning of the season... In the off season, Mika had really, really put an effort into physical training. So he turned up at the beginning of the 2000 season looking much more trim, much more focused, because he knew that Schumacher was going to be difficult to beat. And then just they had car blow ups, they had that silliness with the front wing being too low on Coulthard's car in Australia. And McLaren was such difficult customers. It was not a year to be a McLaren customer during their marriage. Everything was wrong.
Sorry, you go first, because I'm just going to go slightly off on a tangent.
You get the impression as well that Mark Schumacher never really quite regarded Damon Hill as a worthy adversary, which obviously is pretty harsh given that they did fight out champions. But with Hakkinen, you didn't feel like that. With that, you kind of felt like there was a genuine
respect.
Exactly. And which he then had with Fernando Alonso. I think he knew when Alonso arrived, oh God,
yeah.
That's another one.
Okay, I'm just going to... It's not really off on a tangent. Just mention, we've only talked about Schumacher and Hakkinen here. Coulthard Monaco Grand Prix. One of his day of days.
Yes.
You know, how many Grand Prix did he win? 12 Grand Prix? But there was some Grand Prix where he was just outstanding. Yeah. And that was one of them, wasn't it? You know, and that he was a guy who, you know, who just sort of, on those days, he was absolute. As good as anyone else on the grid.
There's been very few lucky winners of Monaco. You know, it's not a race that you luck into the victory. And I know Trantignon sort of collected as other people.
Hang on. We were talking about Patrese in 82.
I think that's the exception that proves the rule.
13 wins, but it was 12 for McLaren. But his own personal race of his life was the French Grand Prix from that year, of course, when the famous giving the finger to Michael and then beating him anyway, and he was clear of Hakkinen that weekend as well. So I think that's a fair point. And actually Rubens Barrichello as well. They're two drivers that were capable of on their day being absolutely top notch. But in a way, that's kind of what I mean about by the end of the season, Schumacher and Hakkinen have raised it so that they're even significantly ahead of those two, which I think shows you the level they were operating on. And the only other year that I had was 2024. Just it was suggested by someone else, but presumably shorter memories. I think possibly, to be fair, it is a great campaign for Max Verstappen. I think it ticks that box. I think it's the right world champion.
Yes,
I think we can all agree on that.
Also, winning in adversity.
Exactly.
That sort of shows you something about a driver, doesn't it?
And he finally got that great wet weather win to his name that we all knew that he was capable of, but hadn't quite got one to hang his hat on.
Brazilian Grand Prix weekend, he was just so he was just head and shoulders above everyone else. You know, the tactics, the maturity, just having a clear head on a crappy day when other people are spinning on the way to the grid or whatever.
Seven winners from four different teams.
So that's
pretty impressive, actually. In 24 races, some genuinely good individual races.
And also the way the season swung, that's what makes it interesting for me.
And also your expectation coming in, because 2023, we've not mentioned, for very good reasons.
Yeah.
Because it was boring as hell, wasn't it? Let's be honest, unless you're a Red Bull Verstappen fan, 2023, not a classic F1 season. And I think everyone assumed it was going to be the same. And then when it wasn't, when McLaren got their act together, and to be fair, Ferrari were pretty, you know, in there as well. Mercedes, if it was cold, as you've written in
Lexus Magazine,
it actually made some of the races interesting, and you didn't know who was going to win in that second half of the year. So I think 2024 of the recent seasons probably did, you know, is worthy of mention. Will 2025 be there?
It's shaping up that way, I think. It's certainly interesting in its permutations.
Well, I'm reluctant to try and end up going through every single season in the 75 years of the World Championship for Drivers. So are there any years that we've not mentioned that we think...
I'm glad you said it correctly there. The 75th anniversary of the World Championship for Drivers.
Not Formula One. Not Grand Prix racing.
Not Grand Prix racing.
Oh, dear Lord.
And, of course, we didn't exclude 1952 and 1953 because they were Formula 2 seasons. We excluded them because they were rubbish. apart from possibly the French Grand Prix, the famous race between Mike Hawthorn and one man or Fangio, don't think they were classic seasons. Alberto Ascari did tend to win those races in, you know, measures of minutes rather than seconds. So, not on the list, those two.
We've not, speaking of French Grand Prix, memorable ones, in our little tour through 1990, we failed to mention Yvan Capelli nearly winning in France.
The Leighton House
March. One of the best-looking Formula 1 cars.
Yeah, it was a nice-looking car.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah. Then that was another age in Newey car, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it wasn't. After he'd been fired by the team because it had been not working properly.
That's so right. Yeah.
New floor, and I think Capelli set it up so that he just had a little lift into scenes rather than having to sort of brake it, and that just lessened the stress on the front left, so he could do the whole race without changing.
And
the
also,
tires.
It was a very smooth circuit.
Yeah.
And isn't it
the only track on which that car was going to work?
Well, isn't it true? There's a story that I've heard, and have I had this corroborated, that whatever wind tunnel they tested it in, Southampton or Imperial College, it would have been one or two of the others. Anyone with some back issues of Autosport in front of them.
I think it's Southampton.
Can check this. But that it was incorrectly calibrated.
Yeah, I think it had a bow in the floor. So when the rolling road was moving, it actually moved up.
Lola had a very similar problem in the late 80s. Yeah, Mark Williams, who was the F3000 designer at the time, that's why the F3000 car went from winning the championship to being hopeless. They were getting all sorts of weird wind tunnel data.
The diffuser of the Leighton House was too aggressive because they thought that it was working, but instead it was
basically the floor, the rolling floor was bowing.
Moving up.
Produced by the
car's producing so much downforce underbody pressure that basically sucking the floor up.
Well, that's funny, is it? Because there's the story about the Lotus 78, isn't there? About how they sort of came up with the idea as
the skirt. Because the model sagged.
Yeah, the model sagged. So it sort of shows you sometimes stuff going wrong in the wind tunnel helps you because you have some kind of eureka moment. Sometimes it does you over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends whether you know that there's a problem or not, at the time that it happens. From what we've discussed, have you decided that you were right, wrong about your choices? Do you want to change your choice? I knew Gary was going to say that.
No change.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm happy with my life choices. But I agree. 1983, wonderful season. But if I had to boil it down, I think I made the right choice.
Sorry, what was your one again?
I picked 1976.
Oh, 76. I wouldn't really argue too much with that because 1976 was the year that changed my life. It's because it's the year Formula One dawned on me.
And was Stuart's point, I think, is that it was one of those breakthrough moments.
Widespread TV coverage, more than one winner, and of course, an epic soap opera.
And it was, for me, it was motor racing arriving on the front pages of the newspapers as well as the rear. You know, the sort of, it was obviously the Playboy James Hunt plus the battle with Lauda, disqualifications, the whole British Grand Prix saga, obviously the accident, so it was just, it was front page news, wasn't it? And funny enough, they made a movie about it.
Yes, yeah. Well, there we go. So
historically inaccurate.
Economical with the actuality.
1976, 1983, 1986. We've only got a range of 10 years there. But I think what we have done...
Well, 86 again.
Hopefully in this series we've done... If we've done nothing else, then we've shown actually there have been lots of fantastic Formula One seasons. And if you've not heard some of these stories before, perhaps go and look at those seasons if you've not seen them at the time or read about them for a while, go and have a look, because there's a rich history of the World Championship to explore, and it's been an enjoyable experience doing it during this series. Thank you very much to Stuart Colley, thank you very much to Gary Watkins, and thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast.